welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we will be talking with Dr. Shannon Fogg, professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology. She'll be talking with us about her new book, Stealing Home: Looting, Restitution, and Reconstructing Jewish Lives in France, 1942 to 1947. Shannon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to our discussion. I wonder if before we talk about the book, if you might tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. As Robin mentioned, I am a professor at Missouri University of Science and Technology. I was lucky enough to come here about 14 years ago, and it's really been a great environment to be able to balance teaching with research and to really be able to focus on the things that are of interest to me. I'm not from Missouri, so this was kind of a transplant. I'm originally from Texas. I went to Texas A&M as an undergraduate, where I thought I was going to be a biology major. And I was planning to go to medical school, but I really wanted to study abroad. I wanted to go somewhere. I tried to convince my parents that I needed to go to Spain to take some Spanish classes. And they thought that was crazy. Since we lived in Texas, I could learn Spanish in Texas without having to go all the way to Spain. And I was walking across campus one day, and someone was handing out these flyers for, it was called the Normandy Scholars Program. And there was a chance to study classes together on campus for a semester and then spend a month in France visiting the places that we had learned about. And it was all focused on France during the Second World War. So I took history courses, political science courses, literature, film. We learned about everything focused on life during the Second World War. And it was so fascinating to me. It was not the history that I had learned in high school. It was not a list of the Allies and the Axis. It was so much more complicated, and it was stuff that I had never heard. I didn't know about Vichy France. I didn't know about collaboration. I had never seen these films before. So I thought, you know, all right, here's a great chance for me to go study abroad. It'll be paid for. I'll finish a minor in history. I'll just finish. And I went, and it completely changed the course of what I was doing. I came back and I changed my major to history and just kind of went from there. It was the time, this is the mid 1990s. So the memory of the war was kind of a big topic in the scholarship. The trials of wartime collaborators are happening around this time. So I really wanted to know more. I started trying to find somewhere. Where can I go? Where can I study this? I contacted Robert Paxton at Columbia, and he said he was about to retire. He'd be retired before I ever got close to getting my PhD. And someone happened to show me an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about Sarah Farmer's work on the massacre at Oradour-sur-Glane that happened at the end of the war. And I contacted her. She was at the University of Iowa at the time, and I ended up going there. They had a great balance there as well between the opportunity to teach and learn those kinds of skills and interact with students and support for research. So I got my master's and my PhD at the University of Iowa. And after graduation, I came here to, it was at the time University of Missouri-Rolla. It's now Missouri S&T. And that's where I've been for the last 14 years.
And with that said, how did you come to write Stealing Home? What brought you specifically to this topic?
Kind of like finding Vichy was an accident. Finding this topic was an accident. I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't really planning to write this book. This isn't what I had in mind when I started. I had just finished my first book and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I thought I would maybe draw on some of the things that I had started researching in that book.
And your first book was on daily life during the Vichy period. Is that right?
Right. Daily life in the rural Limousin and the interactions between the French people and a lot of the refugees who came into the area. And one of the groups that I had looked at was the treatment of children. There were children's homes in the area. And I thought, you know, there's still a lot more to say about children's experiences during the war. Mm. I was teaching for a semester in London in 2009. So I thought, okay, if I'm in London, maybe I can do something comparative. And children who were evacuated from Europe to England, maybe I can look and see what their experiences were, compare that to the evacuated children's experiences in France. So I was going to the archives in London. I was in the British Library one day. I was looking for anything that was connected to France in some way. Hmm. And I came across the published reports of the Mattioli Commission. And that was really the first time that I had come across these. So in 1997, the French Prime Minister, who was Alain Juppé at the time, created a commission to study the question of the spoliation of Jews in France during the Second World War. There had been a lot of discussion of this in the media, and so he put together this work study group to look into the extent of Jewish looting during the war, and then what happened to those items. You know, where did they go? What happened to them? Were people compensated? And the commission worked for a few years, and they published their findings in 2000. And those are all available online. They're PDFs, but I actually saw the book version. And I started looking at these, and I had no idea. I didn't know that there was this commission. I didn't know that people had been looking at it. And there were different topics that they had focused on. There's one on economic Aryanization. There's one on items that were looted from people inside the concentration camps in France. There's one on the looting of artwork. But there's also a separate one on the looting of Jewish apartments during the war and what happened. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting. I don't know anything about this. And I'm really interested in ordinary people's experiences during the war. We often get, you know, the important people or the politicians, but
right.
I'm not one of them. You know, I want to know what life would be like for somebody more similar to me. And everyone, most people have a home. And so what is this home like, and what happens when the home is taken away from you? And so one report, that report on the apartments, one line in there really kind of stood out to me. And it said that, you know, even after all of this time, there was nothing that had been written about restitution. There were no studies. There were no PhD dissertations. There was nothing. There was some stuff on looting, especially like bank accounts and famous artwork and those kinds of things. But there was nothing about the process of how people got their stolen items back. And so I thought, if you're going to look at looting, you also need to look at restitution.
Right. So
that was really the thing that kind of got me interested, is these reports. And I wanted to know more. And I started looking, and there wasn't more. And after that semester in London, I went to Paris for the summer to do research. And so I really started to look into the files, see what was in there, especially the files at the National Archives in series AJ38, which was the wartime files of the CGQJ. It's the organization that was created during the war to deal with the Jewish question. So the Commissariat General Question Juive. Mm-hmm. And that AJ38 also includes the files of the post-war restitution service. They're all grouped together. So it's seen as this continuation as well. So I started looking through there. What's in there? What information is there in about apartments? What information is there about people's homes? What happened to all of these things? And included in the documents are all of the inventories that people sent to the French government after the war. And these are inventories that were created by Jewish victims of looting. Their homes had been emptied during the war. And to get anything back, they had to send an inventory of their apartment's contents. So they literally had to sit and think and list every single item.
And these things weren't, obviously they weren't around them anymore. So they're having to.
Right. They're doing all of this by memory. Right. And so that's one of the things that's kind of interesting is how do people remember? What order are they putting things in? So there are all of these inventories. There's thousands of them. There's over 6,000 of them in there. So they're fascinating. And they tell us much more than just kind of listing the contents of a looted apartment. And so that's really where the project started. And it kind of grew from there. So having these inventories and then trying to figure out what can you do with them. I mean, you can do so many things with them. You can look at material culture and see what people owned. You can do a kind of demographic study. What are the size of apartments? Where are people living? Who's making these claims? So it was kind of starting with that and then kind of building out what other sources do I need to look at to kind of to build up the story of what happens when the government comes in and strips everything out of your home. What do you do when you come back? What does home mean? How do you restart your life? What's the role of material things in that as well? So I really didn't start out specifically wanting to explore this topic, and the project really went where the archives led.
I wonder, just because you quickly mentioned restitution and you talk about the importance of this term early on in the book, I wonder if you want to explain for us the difference between restitution and the other word that we hear a lot when it comes to, you know, dealing with the aftermath of looting, which is reparations.
Right. So immediately after the war, the French government is interested only in returning stolen items. So restitution at this point had purely, it's purely the connotation of returning an item that was stolen. There is no moral connotation, which is what we get with reparations, the idea that you're kind of providing compensation for something that was lost or that you're righting a wrong in the past. You're making some kind of repair. This is purely returning items that have been stolen. So the idea was after the war, there's all of these thousands of apartments. There's 38,000 apartments in Paris that were completely stripped of their belongings. The idea is then some of these items were found, and can they return these items back to their rightful owners? It's not about compensating all of the people who have lost their things. It's solely about returning items that were stolen.
And why do you think it is, or why is it that this topic, you know, hasn't been explored? Of course, the history of, you know, Second World War persecution has been very widely studied, but the story of rebuilding Jewish life after the war hasn't really been told. So why is that?
I think it's a really interesting question. I don't know that I have all of the answers to that, but I think that there's certain trends that we can kind of find. There's certainly more being written about displacement and return now in France, but also more widely in European history. But I think one of the contributing factors is that for a long time, there's been this idea of post-war Jewish silence, that after the war, Jews didn't want to talk about their experiences. They wanted to look to the future, right? They wanted to rebuild their lives. There was no point in looking back, but the point was now to move forward. There are other examples of people who say, you know, I got back, I wanted to talk about what happened to me, but nobody wanted to listen. People didn't want to know. Other people, non-Jews said, you know, we suffered during the war as well. We all suffered. So let's just all move forward. But there's more and more research that comes out that demonstrates that Jews were talking about their experiences after the war. They were writing about it. They were engaging in politics. They were engaging with the government. But that narrative has largely been lost in the scholarship as we moved further away from the war. So there's a lot in the post-war period. And then I think that myth of silence kind of became one of the dominant historiographical narratives. And so that's, I think, one reason that we don't have as much about that post-war period. I think there's several other things we could consider. The process of rebuilding after the war was all-encompassing. Everything in France needed to be rebuilt. You need a new government to be put into place. The infrastructure needs to be rebuilt. The economy needs to shift again. So you have everything that needs to be fixed and focused on. And we often look at those larger kind of issues, those larger overarching trends, right? Women get the right to vote. You have an economic boom. So those are, I think, the things that get attention. There's food shortages at the time. There's housing shortages. So I think these kind of individual stories of people rebuilding their lives, the daily struggles of individuals get lost in these kind of bigger structural shifts. In some ways, it's kind of related, right? The sources, what kind of sources can we use to try and understand what it was like for people to rebuild their lives? If you come back from surviving a concentration camp, or you've been in hiding, or you've, you know, been traveling, and you come back and you've lost everything, you don't have a job, family members are gone, your home has been completely emptied, or somebody else is living in it, your main concern is probably not to write down your experiences of what life is like as it's happening at that point. So they're not documenting the return. There's not an easy source base to go to. And there are paper shortages. I mean, people aren't writing these things down. So I think people have really been interested in understanding, and it's back to the historiography, like how something like the Holocaust could have happened. It was truly extraordinary. But that return to normal is more ordinary. And I think it's not something then that we're, right? The idea is you're just going back to the way things were. So why do we need to look at that when we still have to understand how this even happened to begin with? So I think there are a lot of different reasons why we haven't looked at this process of kind of reintegrating. And after the war, there's also a huge emphasis on the positive aspects of France's history. A lot of focus is put on the resistance. France is trying to find its own way forward with the developing Cold War and what kind of country they're going to be. We're returning to the ideas of a republic and republicanism. Everything is equal, and we're not identifying people by racial or social or ethnic differences anymore. So all of those things, I think, combined mean the focus is on the bigger, or things that people saw as maybe more important than kind of the daily readjustment to life after the war.
And I guess the history of spoliation would definitely be a negative spot in the history of France. So how did the spoliation come about? I mean, how were Jews dispossessed during the Second World War? What were some of their experiences, and how did this process, you know, come to be, both, I guess, from the top down, but also what were their experiences on the ground?
Almost immediately, as soon as the Nazis are in France and the armistice is signed, the Nazis begin a systematic plunder of France. They're looking for these countries that they're conquering as a source of economic support for Germany, for support for the war, to keep their own people well fed and free from shortages, because they had learned from the First World War, right, that people who are experiencing extreme hardship are people who might rebel and make things more difficult. So they come in as June as 1940, as early as June 1940, they're focusing on taking things out of France. They're focused first on artwork, especially, famous pieces of art, other cultural objects, sculptures, library collections. And
so things of like really high value.
Right. And that certainly affected Jews and Jewish collections and Jewish art collectors. But as we kind of advance in the war, the looting of Jewish homes begins later. And it really starts in the spring, officially starts in the spring of 1942 with something that was called the Furniture Operation. And the looting of Jewish homes, it's a coordinated effort, and it is clearly associated with the implementation of the Final Solution in Europe. Alfred Rosenberg, who is in charge of the Eastern Territories, he sends a request to Hitler in December of 1941, asking for permission to strip uninhabited Jewish homes throughout Western Europe so that those items could be sent back to the Eastern Territories, where he said there is a severe lack of furniture. So it's part of the Nazi expansion right into places like Poland, where then they're removing Jews into ghettos and later into death camps. And then, putting Germans into these homes and into these areas, but they needed furnishings. Hitler approved this transfer of goods from Western to Eastern Europe, and the program officially begins in France in January 1942. So the idea was, at this point, it was limited to abandoned apartments. So only uninhabited, abandoned apartments could be looted. But again, this is linked to, the implementation of the Final Solution. And you have to think about why are these apartments abandoned? In many cases, it's people who had fled Paris, right, for their own safety, who had either fled to southern France or to other countries because of the laws that were being implemented, because they saw the danger, because they were experiencing persecution. So their homes are now considered abandoned. And it's also abandoned homes, empty homes, are homes that are no longer occupied because their residents had been arrested and incarcerated and interned and then later deported. So these abandoned apartments, between 1942 and 1944, at least 38,000 of them in Paris were sealed. So that's the first step in the process. If the apartment is identified as being abandoned, it could be sealed under Nazi orders, and seals were placed on the door with a little notice that said, "Do not enter." And then they remain sealed until usually a French moving company came to remove the items. The furnishings, everything inside the apartments were removed. They would come in, they would take the lights off the ceilings, mirrors off the walls, the linoleum off the floor. They pulled out kitchen sinks and took those as well. So absolutely everything was stripped out of these apartments. They were then taken to various depots inside Paris. There were three labor camps, Nazi labor camps inside Paris that were that had Jews who were forced labor working inside these camps. The furniture and the items inside were then sorted. So all of the cups and dishes and saucers, everything went together. The clocks, the children's toys, everything was sorted by category. They were then packaged, and most of them were then shipped to Germany. And it was the Mattioli Commission did kind of do the calculations and looked at all of the things, and more than 674 trainloads, full trains of goods were sent to Germany in this 2-year period. So there's this huge amount of furniture and bedding and kitchen items. Everything is being shipped. And in some cases, the items are being put together as whole apartments. So they might bundle a 2-bedroom working class apartment, and then it's ready to go and it can be shipped to Germany. And then a bombing victim in Germany, a victim of an air raid, the German government could then say, here is all of the stuff that you need for a 2-bedroom working class apartment. So it was this very,
very calculated.
Yes. And then you start to get people kind of wanting there to be more arrests, so there's more furniture available that can be then shipped abroad. But, you know, all of this really, it's not just about the items that are in there, right? It's not just about taking something materially. This is violating people's private space, right? The assumed safety that your home is a safe haven, that this is the center of your family. So you're violating people's sense of security, their sense of belonging. And it also really underscores the fact that the Nazis believed that Jews would not need the contents of their homes anymore, right? That Jews are going to disappear, and that you don't need. And it was meant to be a complete erasure of all traces of Jewish memory in life. They take photographs, they take letters, they throw them in the gutter, right? It's just trying to erase everything associated with Jewish life in the capital. And it's not just removing Jewish influence from the economy, right? This goes beyond that. It's the complete erasure of the daily existence of families.
And it seems like a very German-run operation. The goal was to send furniture to Germany, but what was the extent of like French collaboration? You mentioned that it was French moving companies who would transport the goods, but what sort of collaboration was there, or French participation?
It's interesting. So French at first, right, when the mass arrests begin in 1942, it's then easier for the German authorities or the French police to identify which apartments are abandoned, right? If they have gone and they've arrested someone from that apartment, they know where those apartments are. But before that, when the process started earlier in the spring of 1942, in January 1942, it would be the neighbors who would say, that apartment is empty, right? Can I move in there? Can you get the furniture out of there? Landlords were often complicit in it because they're losing the rental income if people have abandoned it. Right. So they want the government to do something about it, empty that apartment so that they can get somebody else in there and they can get their income back as well. There are people who are asking, you know, we've noticed there's a lot of empty apartments. Can I have something bigger and nicer for my wife and I so we can start a family? Because currently we live in a very small place and we know there's 2 nice apartments in this building. So there's that kind of complicity or opportunistic participation in what's going on. It's very visible. You can't hide a moving truck out in the middle of the street. People see this happening and they see it. And at first, before some of those train loads of goods were being sent to Germany, Jewish furniture was being given to French air bombing victims, especially in Boulogne-Billancourt. Where the Renault factory was. And there was also a French aid organization, they would come with their truck and load up the things and then deliver it to the victims of this wartime thing. And then this was seen very positively that, thanks to the Germans, right, we're supplying these poor war victims with furniture. And then the French become much more skeptical as these things are now being loaded onto trains and being shipped out. And the French government does try to kind of keep control of this. You know, they say this is part of our French patrimony. This is French stuff. We want to keep it here.
I mean, that makes sense just economically that they would
economically want to keep it. As well, right? And they even tried to argue, you know, well, if you're going to take it, then at least calculate the cost of it and deduct that from what we owe you for our occupation costs. That didn't happen either. But there is this kind of, it's not, so there are some protests to the fact that this is happening, but it's not protests because you're taking Jewish goods or what the end result is. It's more protests because the French are losing control over it and they're losing the economic advantage of it as well.
Of course, after this terrible and traumatic experience of deportation or of, escaping to either southern France or a different country, a number of Jews did return. So how did they at first go about attempting to reclaim their previous homes, now lost property? Were they successful in doing so? What were their experiences in doing that?
So, when you look at the documents, there was a lot of things immediately after the war that told people don't come back to Paris. They said, yet they said right now there's no reason for you to come back. Your home is occupied by somebody else. So there's not going to be a place for you to stay. Your job is gone. There's no workshops, so you're kind of better off where you are. But many people came back. Some people came back and found their homes exactly the way they were when they left them. Others came back and found their home completely empty, but no one else living in it. And still others came back and found that their apartment was empty and that somebody else was living in it. So you have various kinds of situations that people return to. Some people knew in advance. Sometimes a neighbor or their concierge had let them know during the war, hey, the Germans came and took all your stuff, if they knew where they had gone. But one of the first things that we see the government really kind of stepping in to do is issuing an ordinance related to housing in November of 1944. And this ordinance really addresses the procedures for people to reclaim their homes. It's set out in such a way that if your apartment that you rented had been occupied by someone else during the war, you could request to return, but there were certain conditions. And it was very vague. It was very much couched in a language of republicanism, of equality, that we all have the right to kind of go back to where we were. But they also acknowledged that due to extreme housing shortages and the destruction of the war, that this wasn't going to happen for everyone. So they try and outline what would allow people to return. So you could request to return if you had been obligated to leave without consent and under the kind of...
Okay, so not if you escaped to the south of your, not of your own free will, but out of pressure.
Well, but it could also be the material or moral duress that was resulting directly or indirectly from the fact of the occupation. So it's fairly broad, but you had to have left after the armistice. So not if you had left freely, like in May during the exode, as the Germans are coming in, then this is a questionable thing, right? Because you fled on your own. So it is very complicated. It's very vague. And there were also a lot of exceptions into the ordinance as well. So if you had left, right, and you meet these other conditions, But if the current tenant was a bombing victim, or the current tenant was an evacuee, someone who had been evacuated maybe from Alsace and Lorraine or the other border regions, if you were a refugee, if you were the spouse or a direct relative of a mobilized soldier or a prisoner of war or a political or labor deportee, you would be exempt from being expelled from that apartment. So there's this process put in place, but it's almost impossible to actually use because so many people were exempt. So really the only people you could kick out is maybe if it was your neighbor who just wanted to expand the size of their apartment, right? But if somebody else who had been a victim of the war in some way had moved into that apartment, they were exempt from being expelled. So it's this idea that no one is going to be singled out for help. There's no special advantages given to Jews whose homes had been looted and then reoccupied. Everybody is kind of in the same situation. And so people find it very difficult. I mean, it was very difficult to get this housing back. You could take the current inhabitants to court to try and reclaim your apartment. And oftentimes people might win the court case, but then it was much more difficult to actually get someone to follow the law, right? To actually move out. And throughout the spring of 1945, so if this ordinance passed in November and people are trying to apply it, throughout the spring of 1945, there are protests throughout Paris when Jews are trying to reclaim their homes. Organizations would come together. There's an example of somebody, the concierge had moved into the apartment of a Jewish inhabitant. The Jewish survivor comes back. They're given the right to return to their home. They're starting to move all of the concierge's things out of the apartment and into a moving van, and a large mob comes and they take the furniture and they move it back in. So you have these kinds of protests. You have physical violence against Jews. Crowds would come. They would beat up the Jewish survivor who is coming back. There was one woman who was slapped in the face when she tried to go back into her apartment. So it's very difficult. There we also see a lot of expressions of anti-Semitism that continue after the war. And why would you give an apartment back? You know, the reasoning was it's inhabited now by a good Frenchman. Why would you give it back to a foreign Jew? So you see anti-Semitism, you see xenophobia, you see this kind of hierarchy of suffering. We suffered, we're victims. Why can they get their house back? And why are you going to kick somebody else out? So, and it, you know, it's a very small number of Jews, right? 38,000 apartments, but the number of Jewish deportees, survivors who come back are much smaller than the 5 million people whose houses had been bombed, or the million POWs who return. So there are all of these different groups that are competing for access to these houses, to these homes. And with this new Republican government, there's a commitment to equality and not distinguishing between the different groups. So you have this real struggle after the war.
Yeah, I think that I feel like we usually think of return after the war as something that was, you know, joyous and maybe even sort of marked the end of this like terrible anti-Semitic blight that had happened over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. But it seems like by looking at the experiences of homes and of trying to return home, it's clear that there are some enduring and some new tensions between French Jewish and French non-Jewish society.
Absolutely. And in some of the, I used some oral histories and some memoirs as well. And a lot of people, almost everything that I read or listened to, they mentioned that first return home. And in a lot of cases, they said, it was almost worse coming back after the war than what they had endured during the war. Their treatment after the war was, you know, people said, oh, you didn't all die, or, oh, you came back, or returning to an empty home was very emotional. You know, children who had been hidden, they come back and all traces of their family, everything that connected you to your life before, is gone. Some people wanted to stay in those apartments. You know, they said I was hoping that my parents were going to come back and then they would have a home to return to, even though I knew that this was never going to happen. It was like this psychological need to be there in case somebody came back. So in some ways, this return was much harder. The waiting, the loss of, you know, people said the loss of their memories, right? Their memorabilia, the photographs, the blanket that was made for you by your grandmother, right? Your favorite doll. Those were the things that were kind of more meaningful than the loss of, you know, a couch or a bureau or something. So there was this, what does home mean and what makes a home? And so those are all questions that people were dealing with as well.
Right. In some ways, I mean, the writing down of, you know, the list that you were talking about earlier of all of the items that were in your apartment before the war is really like a memory act or ritual in a way.
It is. And especially, you know, one thing that happens is that a restitution service will be finally created in January 1945, dedicated solely to returning these recovered items. And so you had the first step in getting a chance to see what items were there was to have sent in these inventories. But the restitution service dealt only with domestic use identifiable furniture. So the only thing that they're interested in are in unique pieces, something that you can look at and say, that is definitely mine. So anything that was kind of modern mass manufactured, they weren't going to return because there's no way to say that what now, right, for us, that IKEA bed is my IKEA bed. It had to have been, you know, some Louis XIV furniture or something. They weren't returning any of your kitchen utensils. I mean, if you knew what your refrigerator serial number was, maybe you could get that's something identifiable. But so the fact that all of these people are sending in these extensive inventories that include things like how many bottles of wine they had and how many spoons and how many brooms they had, right? They're putting everything that was in their apartment. They're remembering everything that was in there. Even though the only thing that you're allowed to actually go visit to try and find is domestic use identifiable furniture, and it's only the things that were recovered in France. And the majority, more than 80% of the things that were looted were sent to Germany. They're not even dealing with trying to get things from somewhere else. It's solely the things that didn't make it out of France, right? That were on a train and or in a warehouse waiting, and the train got stopped before it was able to cross over into Germany. So the fact that people are really participating in this, you know, they want to remember, but they're also engaging with the government. Right? That this is a way to have a voice, to maybe recognize the legitimacy of this new kind of government, this expectation that they're going to do something to help you. So these inventories are more than just, you know, a way to get looted items back.
Right. And let's stick with this restitution service for a minute. So, you know, what exactly is its, I mean, you've talked about its goal, but what does it really end up doing for people? But also, what does it tell us about this sort of intersection between public and private lives, the role that the French government is playing in intimate and, you know, private Jewish lives?
So the restitution service, it's created in January 1945. It's under the French Ministry of Finance. Kind of before that, people were sending their claims to kind of the property department of the French government. So this is to focus solely on the the restitution of these looted goods. And their job was really to make sure that all of the legislation that's being passed is enforced in terms of the looting and spoliation process, so that you reverse all of those things. They could make suggestions for new or additional measures. And then their job is really to keep the finance minister informed of how restitution is progressing. And one of the things that I find really most interesting about this is there's this huge bureaucracy, and you have thousands of people sending in these letters. Basically, they had found about 2,400 pieces of furniture, right? That's all, of the 38,000, right? It's not a lot. Out of the 38,000 apartments, and think of all of the things that go into furnishing an apartment, there's 2,400 pieces of furniture that had been found. And in the end, less than 2,000 of them were returned. So it's not really so much about the actual physical restitution of items. It's more about these bigger issues too. It's about recognizing, right, that Jews are now part of the nation again, and that participating in the political process, of having your voice heard, of recognizing that that they were singled out and targeted, and that their items were stolen, that this is part of a larger genocidal process. This is all related, that spoliation and the restitution is all showing us the ways that these private areas become very public and become very political. And I think that the despoilment process is just an extension of other ways that the Nazis and the Vichy government are trying to regulate people's daily lives, right? Through rationing. What you eat is now the government's business. Who you marry and whether you can get a divorce is now part of the government's business. Your identification, right? Identification cards are stamped, curfews that are imposed. All of these things are meant to destabilize people's lives, and they intrude into your private life and make it part of the public sphere. And the same thing for restitution, right? The government is taking a role in rebuilding the physical space of your home, and who has access to which apartments and what things can you put in there and who has priority for those things. So I think all of these, right, that public policies are really going into private spaces. And what do you want happening in these private spaces, right? You want the reconstitution of families, and you want children to be born into these families. And that's a sign of returning to normal. So it's also thinking about demographics and what France is going to look like in the future. So all of these things kind of come into play just by looking at an apartment or a home, right? And what happens in there.
One part of the book that I found particularly fascinating is your discussion of how the home has, you know, traditionally been regarded as a feminine space or a woman's domain. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how gender played into the history of spoliation, but also restitution and the reconstruction of Jewish homes and lives in France.
Sure. And that was one of the things that I thought was really interesting. So that November ordinance and the people who are allowed to re-enter the home, it assumes a patriarchal, male-dominated family. And so the renter, usually the man, right, has the ability to reclaim his home. But what happens then if the man has been deported? Because more men statistically were deported from France than women. So that's one aspect. All of those people who are excluded from being expelled, their male categories, right? Prisoners of war and their wives, or labor deportees, usually male. Right? So there are all of these things were kind of male-centric, but women are seen as the keepers of the home. And in these restitution letters, it's very interesting because sometimes you'll see men will write the letter, and then another letter will come in and say, sorry, my wife was still in the countryside, and so I tried to make a list of the things in our house, but I didn't remember everything. And so my wife has added to the list. So, but there's the idea that the man is the one who should interact with the government. There were some exceptions, of course, right? Single women, widowed women, women whose husbands had been deported, they're writing their letters, but they usually identify their connection to a man in some way, right? My husband was deported. My son is a prisoner of war, or my son fought for France. So there's this idea that there's some connection. But you see women taking a very active role in the restitution process, in writing these letters, in asking for permission to try and find their items as well. So it's also an interesting time period, right? Women get the right to vote in France in 1945. So what kind of political engagement are they engaging in? And some of it is just interacting with the restitution service, making demands. Sometimes as the woman, right, I want to have a comfortable home for my family when they return. And others just as getting their rights back. Right, and being part of it as well. So you do see kind of the still idea that men are the head of the household, but you see women participating in this process a lot more. And there's also this idea of returning to normal meant that people had a home, they had a family. So we see people rebuilding families, kind of extended families, so finding relatives that can all live together and help support each other, or friends, putting friends together in kind of new family units, and also encouraging women to work to support their families, especially if the male head of household did not return. And that was seen as now normal. Work was normal, family was normal, and being in a safe, clean home was part of that as well.
And how did Jewish organizations assist in the rebuilding process? I mean, how were associations, whether French communal associations or international Jewish associations, significant in this history?
So people turn to them directly, right? So you have the government that's doing things. So some Jews kind of turn externally. And if things aren't going fast enough in that way, people turn to internal Jewish organizations to ask for help. They saw them as organizations that could lobby the government to make sure that laws were being passed, that things were happening more quickly. They're also providing a lot of aid. Those people, when they did return, if they didn't have a place to live, they might provide some temporary housing. They might provide a little financial assistance. They might provide a loan so that somebody could buy a sewing machine and start sewing and selling things to support themselves again. So there's different ways that that the Jewish organizations are there. So there's some financial support, there's some kind of job training support, there's interacting with the government. They also talked about, they did some petitions, especially when there's difficulty in getting people back into their houses. They talked about propaganda campaigns. They felt that if people truly understood what had happened to the Jews during the war, they would be more supportive and there wouldn't be some of the issues and conflicts after the war. They start gathering information and documenting all of these things because they felt that that was important to have a record of this as well. Foreign aid organizations, especially the American Joint Distribution Committee, is providing financial support. There's also the creation of a new organization called the COJASOR, which was created to coordinate aid activity in Paris so that people had kind of one place to go rather than trying to go to five different agencies looking for, you know, additional food or a place to live or a job. So it was meant to kind of coordinate everything and help get people up and back to this idea of normal, whatever normal was after such a horrific and incomprehensible experience that they had just been through. So you really have the organizations kind of, you have an inward and external kind of role that they're playing. They're working with the government, but they're also working with the Jewish community to try and rebuild and deal with the issues that are surrounding the material issues, but also kind of the continuing anti-Semitism and xenophobia that people were facing as well.
Shannon, we've taken up a lot of your time, and this has been a fantastic discussion. But before I let you go, I'm wondering if I can ask you what you're working on next.
Sure. So I kind of have two things that I'm doing right now. One of them is I'm going back to these inventories because there's so much in them. And when I use them this time, there's over 6,000 of them I sampled, and I looked for the ones that had the most kind of additional information. But now I'm going through them and trying to map all of the addresses to see if we can get kind of a geography, an urban geography of restitution. Who's making these claims? Where are they making these claims? Does it fit the patterns that we expect? Are they coming from wealthy Jews? Are they coming from working class areas?
Interesting.
So that's one of the things that I'm working on. And there's a team of researchers in France that's also been working on this kind of urban geography of both persecution and I'm kind of looking at the restitution aspect. And then the other thing I'm working on is a kind of longer, broader project, and it's on the role of the American Friends Service Committee and their aid in France during the war. As a Quaker organization, an American organization that was allowed to work in France as humanitarian aid, and why they're allowed to do that, what kind of networks they had, and how they provided aid inside the concentration camps, and they actually contributed to the rescue of Jews in France as well. And we don't really have a comprehensive history of what they did during the war. So that's the other kind of longer term project.
Yeah, that's not something I have any knowledge of. It sounds fascinating.
And there's tons of, and it's one of those things that you get in a rabbit hole. There's tons of archival material. They sent letters back to Philadelphia. Everything that they did in France had to be approved. So there's all of these written records, which I'm kind of buried in documents. So this is really much longer term.
Right. Well, those sound like some fascinating projects. I hope to have you back on the show when you've finished that project, not to put any pressure on. Shannon, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was great to share a little bit about this project with you.
That was Shannon Fogg talking about her new book, Stealing Home, Looting, Restitution, and Reconstructing Jewish Lives in France, 1942 to 1947, which is out from Oxford University Press. This has been New Books in Jewish Studies. Thanks for listening.